What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Following the Holy Prophet in Islamic morality.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
پیروی از پیغمبر در اخلاق که خدای متعال فرمود انک لعلی خلق عظیم.
As for ethics and morality, we should follow the Holy Prophet's example in ethics. God, the Exalted, said, and you stand on an exalted standard of character. The Holy Quran, Surah 68, verse 4. Something that our Creator has said is an exalted standard of character. It's something extraordinary, and you stand on an exalted standard of character. Such morality should always receive our attention and be a guideline for us. We should behave in an Islamic way and be humble and forgiving. These are examples of Islamic ethics. We should be tolerant in personal matters. Of course, being tolerant is not permissible with regards to public matters and that which is related to the rights of the people. But in the case of personal matters, we can be tolerant. We should be kind towards others and avoid lying, insulting, and having doubts about the believers. We should also forgive the believers. One of the supplications in Sahifa Sajjadiya says, O God, I forgive everyone who has done an act of injustice towards me, who has said an untrue thing about me, and whom I can bring to justice. This is Imam Sajjad's supplication in Sahifa Sajjadiya. These are examples of Islamic ethics. We should carry out our duties in this regard.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Dear brothers, dear sisters, we have to act and we have to take action. Issues do not end with claims. We claim to be Muslims. We claim to be the Islamic Republic. Therefore, we must be truly Islamic. We must follow the Holy Prophet. This great blessed anniversary of this birth is an opportunity to think about and study this issue and to show our true determination on this path. I congratulate all of you again. I congratulate the dear Iranian nation. I congratulate all the Muslims throughout the world and the Islamic nation. I congratulate all the liberated people in the world. And I send greetings to the pure souls who were martyred on the path of Islam and the path of the school of the Prophet. I send greetings to the pure soul of our magnanimous Imam who opened up this path to us and who guided us towards this great endeavor. I ask God the Exalted to bestow His paradise and His mercy on all of them. And I ask Him to bestow success on the people of Iran, in particular on you, officials, on you, dear guests, and on us. Greetings be upon you, and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
in the limelight. Recently, the U.S. government held the largest ever auction of oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf of Mexico's history, offering up more than 18 million acres of the Gulf's seabed for fossil fuel extraction. We now present you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, Revealed, Biden Administration Was Not Legally Bound to Auction Gulf Drilling Rights. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The Biden administration admitted that a court decision did not compel it to lease vast tracts of the Gulf of Mexico for oil and gas drilling, shortly before claiming it was legally obliged to do so when announcing the sell-off. Recently, the U.S. government held the largest ever auction of oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf of Mexico's history, offering up more than 80 million acres of the Gulf's seabed for fossil fuel extraction. The enormous sale, which took place just 4 days after crucial United Nations climate talks in Scotland, represented a spectacular about-turn from Joe Biden's previous promise to halt offshore drilling and was denounced by outraged environmental groups as a huge carbon bomb. President Biden's administration insisted it was obliged to hold the lease sale due to a court ruling in favor of a dozen states that sued to lift the blanket pause placed on new drilling permits by President Biden. But The Guardian revealed a memo filed by the U.S. Department of Justice before the lease sale acknowledges that this judgment does not force the U.S. government to auction off drilling rights to the Gulf of Mexico. Government lawyers to the federal court in Louisiana in August wrote, "While the order enjoins and restrains the Department of Interior from implementing the pause, it does not compel Interior Department to take the actions specified by plaintiffs, let alone on the urgent timelines specified in plaintiffs' contempt motion." The memo states the issuance of new drilling permits would require further steps under federal laws, adding, "The court's order does not compel the agency to act in contravention of other authorities." The memo's language was first referenced by the Daily Poster. However, just a month after arguing that it was not required to hold the sale, the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management announced it would auction off an area of the Gulf of Mexico that is 2 times the size of Florida to oil and gas companies. The expanse of the Gulf put up for auction contains around 1.12 billion barrels of oil and 4.2 trillion cubic feet of gas, with the leases locking in years and potentially decades of planet-heating emissions. It comes at a time when the International Energy Agency, the IEA, has said no new fossil fuel projects can be established after this year if the world is to avoid catastrophic heat waves, flooding, and other disastrous impacts from runaway climate change. Thomas Mayer, National Organizing Manager of Food and Water Watch, said, "The Biden administration has been misleading on this, to put it mildly. It's very disappointing," adding, "They didn't have to hold this sale, and they didn't have to hold it on this timeline." Thomas Mayer said, "We know this will exacerbate the climate crisis, it undermines U.S. credibility abroad, and it contradicts a campaign promise made by Joe Biden. If the administration was taking the climate crisis seriously, they would be fighting tooth and nail to keep every molecule of fossil fuel in the ground. They are nowhere near to doing that. The auction, held on 17th of November, ended up netting the government $191.6 million from companies such as Exxon, Chevron and BP, the company responsible for the Deepwater Horizon disaster in 2010. A total of 308 tracts of the Gulf of Mexico's seabed were sold off, covering 1.7 million acres, an area larger than the state of Delaware. The rapid staging of the lease sale was not required by the courts of law and could have instead been delayed by a proper federal review of climate and other environmental impacts, according to Earth Justice, an environmental group that is suing to halt the leases before they come into effect in February. Brittany Hardy, a senior attorney at Earth Justice, says, "Interior Department had a lot of discretion over whether to hold this sale, this lease sale, and they chose to do it anyway. The Biden administration is talking about a climate crisis and getting to net zero emissions, and then it makes decisions like this that lock us into impacts for decades to come. These leases could potentially be producing oil 50 years from now. We have no good answer as to why they're doing this. It's problematic and it's disappointing." A spokesperson for the Department of the Interior said that it was complying with a U.S. District Court's decision in going ahead with the leases. He did not answer questions over why the government said in August that this court decision does not compel the auction. The decision to go ahead with the sale has damaged Joe Biden's climate credentials after the COP26 talks in Glasgow, where he said the United States would lead by example in slashing greenhouse gas emissions. The president, who has called the climate crisis an existential threat to the United States, said in a Democratic primary debate last year that under his administration there would be no more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period, ends number one. This jarring contradiction has alarmed even some of Joe Biden's closest allies, with three Democratic members of Congress filing a brief recently with the federal court calling for a halt to the Gulf lease sales. The three admitted that they are deeply concerned and shocked that the government is pushing ahead with the drilling despite its own findings that the largest lease sale in history has not had an adequate environmental review. President Biden has set a target for the United States to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and the use of the huge amount of land and ocean overseen by the federal government is seen as critical to this goal. The production and consumption of fossil fuels on federal land causes about a quarter of all American greenhouse gas emissions, and a president has broad unilateral powers to limit or expand oil, gas, and coal development. The Biden administration's apparent reluctance to aggressively wield this authority may cost it politically, as well as worsen the climate crisis ahead of midterm elections next year. Thomas Mayer said, "This is not going to help with Democratic turnout next year. There is a core constituency of young people and people who care about climate change who are upset and feeling betrayed by the Biden administration." Some commentators have pointed to Joe Biden's need to appease Senator Joe Manchin, a fossil fuel-friendly centrist Democrat who is a crucial vote for the president's Build Back Better spending bill, as a reason for the drilling. Hardy said, "If it is political, that is unfortunate because the climate doesn't really care about politics. Climate change will continue to cause problems for the whole nation if we don't address it now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Our support for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party is plummeting after a series of scandals. The latest allegation of misconduct surrounds a Christmas party by his staff at the peak of a Tier 3 COVID lockdown last year. Now, his spokesperson has stepped down over the controversy, but the British public seem to want more, maybe even Johnson's resignation. But some analysts ask, how is that the holding of an illegal Christmas party will cause more outrage from the British public than their government's support for killing civilians in places like Yemen and Palestine? Is there a problem here with the overall moral compass? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December, while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about two more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister, okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political analyst out of Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Let's start this off in Bristol. And Tony, your take on the overall reaction of the British public and dealing with this Christmas party scandal.
Well, look, Marcia, it's gone from hero to zero, hasn't he? The man who could get Brexit done and now he's plummeting in the polls. But there's two important aspects to this that haven't really been covered, I don't think, anywhere near enough. One of them is, if Boris Johnson is to go, who is going to replace him? And I think we always got to look at the man standing in the shadows behind the curtain. And that would almost certainly be Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, who is very much a creature of the City of London. He's a former employee of some of the big financial institutions. And that would, of course, put them in the driving seat rather than the Conservative Party as a whole. So, you know, we need to look carefully at, you know, maybe what's going on here. If Boris is going to be moved out of the way, who is going to be taking his place? Very important. People often forget that. It's very easy to throw mud at whoever's in power. And what we often forget is that actually maybe they are just put there in power by some more powerful forces behind the scenes. I think that's mostly the case in Western politics anyway. The other thing is that this seems to have all happened because Boris has instituted this thing called Plan B a fortnight or so ago. And there's been increasing calls from all sides for him to go because of this. Now, this is as a massive overreaction, in my view, to the Omicron variant. Now, you know, some have called this Omicron variant a gift from God, because what it does is it enables people to become immune after catching it, and it's very unlikely that anyone will die of it. It's a very mild version of the disease. So rather than embracing this, this has been jumped on as a terrible, terrible thing. And I think there's many people on all sides of the political spectrum, and particularly in the press, who feel that what Johnson's done by overreacting to this and following along with some of the alarmist speculation about the tens of thousands of deaths and hospitalisations that may result from something which the South Africans tell us is very mild is also related to this. So, I mean, I think it's clear that the press is leading this. And also, I think, whereabouts have these leaks come from, these leaks about the party? Let's look at the facts. So the party that Boris Johnson is alleged to have presided over, he wasn't at that party, and he took no part in it. So it's quite feasible that it was arranged by somebody who was at Downing Street, like his chief of staff, etc., behind his back. And I think that's not impossible, although, of course, he may well have known about it, and certainly the police who would guard 10 Downing Street would certainly have known about it. So it's very strange that they didn't act at the time. There are actually a lot of prosecutions going through in Britain still, right now, of ordinary people like you and I that were caught having apparently illegal parties at this time of year. Why not the top people? So the police have got a lot of questions to answer too on that occasion. So okay. I think, you know, what I'm trying to do, Marty, is trying to get behind this, because I'm a bit, little bit concerned when I see the press all going at the same time. And I'm also always very, very aware of if Boris is moved out of the way, who's going to take over and what influences do they represent?
Okay, all right, well, let me get that in on this conversation. I think many say that the public's upset because they feel that Johnson lied, at least as Tony says, that's exactly what's being talked about in the press. But, I mean, it wasn't like he was known to be an honest person before he was elected as Prime Minister, from his extramarital affairs to so many other situations, whether we're talking about Brexit, are other lies that he has been known to tell. So, I mean, what is it that all of a sudden, as Tony has said, I mean, there seems to be an unbelievable reaction when you didn't elect an honest person to begin with. I mean, why such an uproar? You're thinking that maybe he lied now. I mean, what is this really about in your perspective?
Well, I would have to say it's possible that there's some form of a political coup going on in the background. If you remember that this actual accusation about the party in Downing Street was nearly 12 months ago, so obviously this evidence, this videotape, this recording has been in someone's hands for 12 months before it's been put out into the public domain. So it's possible there's a political coup in the background orchestrated by other members of the Conservative Party, indeed maybe front bench members of the Conservative Party, who want to oust Johnson in favour of a new leader. That said, it was only in 2019 that Boris Johnson was denying accusations that he burnt a £50 note in front of a homeless person when he was a student many years ago in London. I think we should bear in mind that there have been scandals all the way through his premiership. We had the Dominic Cummings affair, and then we had Lee Ferguson resign, a senior analyst with the government. Boris Johnson has a track record of being a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and he's someone who talked himself into power and talks himself out of trouble. I don't think Johnson will actually go anywhere. There's an 80-seat majority for the Conservative Party within the British Parliament. He's probably in a stronger position than any party political leader has been in decades. And I think it's very important for Boris Johnson that having such a large majority in the House, and there is no election plan before May 2024, I think he will just ride this out the same way he has done with every other political scandal in his career to date.
But Tony, Labour leader there is saying it's a problem, basic question of trust. And again, I mean, we look at this and it's almost comical, I guess, unfortunately, when we hear politicians talk about trust, but especially, again, Boris Johnson and his given record. It just seems, as you already mentioned, there seems to be political maneuvering out of this, that someone is trying to get to something else, of course, with the cover of this Christmas party. I mean, as you said, you're a journalist, so especially journalists know that when the mainstream media makes a big deal out of something, you better look behind it and see exactly what's going on. So you talked about some of the possibilities of the political maneuvering taking place here. Where do you see this going exactly? Do you think, opposite from our guest in Belfast, that it could actually cause the fall of Johnson or not?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I do, because, first of all, I'll say it was just over a year ago, all these so-called parties, etc., and now the things we've seen as evidence parties, happened about a year ago. But it was just before that, the resignation of Dominic Cummings behind the scenes. Now, he was the chief of staff at Downing Street, and he's a very Machiavellian character. He brags about reading Sun Tzu's Art of War and The Prince by Machiavelli. These kind of it doesn't seem as if he was in there to do a good job for the public. He was there to do political manoeuvring. It may well be him that spearheaded the release of these various leaks at this particular time. And this is one of the things that happens, I think, I'm afraid, in journalism too, is that journalists and editors will hang on to stuff for a long time in order to use it to threaten and eventually maybe use it to manoeuvre out a specific individual, in this case Boris Johnson. Now, there's another aspect to this, and that is there's something in the Conservative Party called the 1922 Committee, and this is a big, powerful committee of backbenchers, people who are not involved in the government. In other words, they're not on Boris's payroll. But what they can do is they can order a vote of the membership of the parliamentary party and of the whole Conservative Party of confidence in Boris. So even though Boris has got a big majority in the Houses of Parliament, it may be his own party can unseat him and replace him, even though he's in that position. So that is entirely possible. But I think it's also fascinating and very important, you mentioned yourself, the killing of civilians in Yemen and places like this, because of course all this gets drowned out in the distraction of what's going on at Westminster, which is effectively it's internal Conservative Party manoeuvrings, I think, that's going on. And it's not helped by the fact that the Labour Party is in fact on Tuesday this coming week, the Labour Party is due to vote with Boris, supporting Boris in the stricter COVID measures he's trying to bring in, whereas many of his own party are revolting against him. Well, what this means is that the Labour Party, the opposition party in Britain, could potentially bring down the government from voting against it and embarrass it, but it's choosing to vote with Boris instead. So there's a 40, 50, 60 backbenchers conservatives about to vote against Boris Johnson, and Labour could have voted with them and made it very, very difficult for Boris to continue and to have any credibility. They have chosen. So what I'm saying is the real opposition politically in the Houses of Parliament, in the House of Commons today, is the Conservative Party. And that is an extraordinary position to be in the country. So distraction away from these wars abroad, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. This is still carrying on with British military facilities being moved over to Saudi Arabia to aid this bombing of Yemen, etc., which is continuing to this day. I think that these are the sorts of issues that get drowned out. What I'd like to see is some real, genuine leadership in the country, and also some genuine attitudes from the press in right across the Western world in calling out some of this horrifically amoral, immoral, attempts to manoeuvre, particularly in the Middle East. And of course, we've had the appalling news about the injustices to Julian Assange, which Boris Johnson himself doesn't seem to have mentioned once, even though it's one of the most important court cases ever to take place on the planet, which is taking place right now in London. Boris has nothing to say about that, and that's another reason why he's losing support fast.
Okay, well, turning back to Belfast, I mean, your perspective, and Tony just mentioned, for example, Assange, and I want to look at that situation, that we don't see that type of outrage one would think would see coming out of the British public. And again, I go back to London's support for repressive regimes, whether we're talking about Israel or Saudi Arabia, or we're talking about Bahrain, that they're giving these weapons to these repressive regimes and supporting them in so many different ways. And yet nothing is said. Is it because the British public, the public is not informed? Is it that they don't care? Or is it the role of the media? How do you assess this overall?
Well, I think what you've asked is a very, very, very interesting question. If we stick with Julian for just one second, his exposure of the Afghan warlog by warlogs was what brought him to the attention and WikiLeaks of the world public. He exposed war crimes carried out by America, done in the name of the American people, part of the propaganda war that's preceded nearly everything that's happened with these humanitarian interventions throughout the world on behalf of Britain, NATO, America, mainly at the behest and in favour of strengthening Israel's position within the region by attacking strong anti-Zionist governments that stand with and beside the Palestinian people. So Julian is suffering from the revenge of the American administration for him showing the world what America is doing in the name of democracy and these humanitarian interventions. I think that Britain is completely complicit in the war crimes that are carried out within West Asia and the Middle East. I don't think that some people who claim Britain or the lapdogs of America and have somehow, you know, bowed down to American demands to have Julian Assange extradited. I think Keir Starmer's, who was involved in the original prosecution, I believe Boris Johnson and the whole British establishment are more than happy to see Julian Assange face 175 years in the darkest, deepest hole that they can find in the American penal system. So Britain is complicit and has always been complicit in its own colonial history and in its present bombing of Yemen, probably secret attacks in Syria, the destruction of Libya. They are all birds of a feather, these neoliberal, colonial, quasi-imperialist, capitalist governments that are there to demonize and to extract resources from the southern hemisphere to come to the northern hemisphere. And I believe that the reason, quite possible, that a lot of this is just pure distraction from the debacle of Brexit, from Julian's extradition, from everything that else is happening. It could be smoke and mirrors. Look over here as a distraction while we continue to bomb, maim and terrorize people throughout the globe.
Well, Tony, it just seems that there is a lack of any type of moral compass in British politics. It just seems that it's money, it's economics over morality. I mean, your perspective on that and the effect of that type of mentality and those who are ruling the country, the effect that it has overall.
Well, look, I want to reassure you, Marcia, it's actually not all over British politics. There is actually a very important faction in both of the main political parties which does have a moral compass. It's just that the way the system works is that the Prime Minister will recruit yes-men, and I would say actually what he's dealing with is a dwindling supply of them, into the cabinet. I mean, for example, we've got, you know, a Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who was involved in all these secret meetings with the Israeli government, and yet she was invited back in, even though she broke the ministerial code when she was International Development Secretary. She was presiding over a massive assault against a vigil in the city, in the centre of London on Clapham Common, and yet she suffered no penalty because of that. I think Boris Johnson is paying the price of sticking with this small coterie of amoral Conservative MPs who he's managed to recruit into the cabinet. But there is, as I said, quite a force out there within the backbenchers in the Parliamentary Conservative Party who are getting increasing. They're looking at the numbers. The numbers of MPs who are pro-Boris and anti-Boris, and also the numbers of members of the Conservative Party, and they're realising they're getting to the point where maybe they can just unseat Boris and replace him with somebody else. And quite who that, I mean, that, like I said, it may be Rishi Sunak. But I think we also need to look, when we're looking at the perspective of all these sometimes incomprehensible wars that are going on in the Middle East, the British and the Americans particularly have been supporting, that there is a long-term plan, first, during the Second World War, to institute the State of Israel, and secondly, to create a war in order to discredit all the three main monotheistic faiths. And this, I think, has been ongoing for a long time, and many people haven't actually seen that this is an attempt to actually... I mean, people say, like my own family, I talk to them and they say, well, no one wants a war. Well, actually, some people do. For these sort of spiritual and ideological reasons, they want to have a war to discredit these faiths, and they also want to have that war to make a lot of money. And so the only forces we've got are within the House of Commons, the people who are not in the key positions in Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson's cabinets, you know, the shadow cabinet Starmer's got, and those are the people, I think, that may make a difference here.
Okay.
And it's very important that we keep a very close eye on what these backbenchers are up to, because they will decide Boris's fate.
All right. And for 1 minute, where do you see all of this going in and affecting British politics? Your assessment overall?
Well, I think there was a very interesting poll that came out recently, a YouGov poll on how politicians act in power and why they are there. 5% of the respondents said that politicians were there to work on behalf of the public, and 63% of the respondents said the politicians were there to promote themselves. So what we have are millionaires and billionaires in an elite clique within the political structures that govern the country, and people like ourselves see them for what they are, They are people who are self-promoters and are using politics in order to line their own pockets.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on the Spotlight, out of Bristol, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, and out of Belfast, Brock Hughes, journalist and political analyst. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. Make sure you join us right here next time. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
The limelight.
The former Trump White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, previously provided the House Committee with thousands of pages of documents, including text messages he received on 6th of January. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, House Seeks Contempt Charge Against Meadows in 6th of January Inquiry. House of Representatives voted on Tuesday night, 14th of December, to recommend holding Mark Meadows, who served as Chief of Staff to former President Donald J. Trump, in criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with its investigation into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, escalating a legal battle against a potentially crucial witness in a widening inquiry. The vote of 222 in favor, 208 against, sent the matter to the Justice Department to consider whether to prosecute Mark Meadows, who would be the first former member of Congress to be held in contempt of the body he once served in nearly 200 years, according to congressional aides. Two Republican members of the committee, Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who served on the committee investigating the attack over the objections of their party, joined Democrats in voting to find Mark Meadows in contempt. But while the action indicated a stalemate between Mr. Meadows and Congress, his initial cooperation with the inquiry, including around 9,000 pages of documents Mark Meadows turned over, has already given the committee its first substantial burst of momentum and political traction as it tries to establish a full accounting of the events that led to the deadly riot on 6th of January. More revelations emerged on Tuesday, 14th of December, before the vote, as Liz Cheney, the vice chairwoman of the committee, read aloud text messages that Republicans in Congress sent to Mark Meadows on 6th of January as violence engulfed the Capitol. "It's really bad up here on the Hill," one said. "The president needs to stop this as soon as possible," another implored. "Fix this now," another said. The committee also divulged on a 4th of November message from an unidentified Republican member of Congress to Mark Meadows, before states were even finished counting ballots, proposing an aggressive strategy in which Republican-controlled legislatures in Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and other states would just send their own electors, instead of potential Biden electors chosen by the voters. How did this text influence the planning of Mark Meadows and Donald Trump to try to destroy the lawful Electoral College majority that had been established by the people of the United States and the states for Joe Biden? Said Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat of Maryland and a member of the committee. Liz Cheney's recitation of the messages from Republicans during a meeting of the Rules Committee before the House began debating the contempt charge was a stark reminder that there was a moment when prominent conservative figures, GOP lawmakers, and even Donald Trump's son had been appalled by the violence at the Capitol and agreed it was the president who needed to stop it. As the violence was underway on 6th of January, it was evident to all, but we know that for 187 minutes, President Donald Trump refused to act, said Liz Cheney, who was ousted from her Republican leadership post for speaking out against Mr. Trump's election lies. And he refused to act when his action was required. It was essential, and it was compelled by his duty, compelled by his oath of office. The revelations were also being watched in the U.S. Senate, where Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, said on Tuesday that while he was not among the lawmakers sending text messages to Mark Meadows on 6th of January, he was paying close attention to what House investigators might uncover. "We're all watching, and you are, and what's unfolding on the House side, and it will be interesting to reveal all the participants that were involved," he told reporters outside of the Senate chamber. After initially expressing outrage at what unfolded on 6th of January, Republicans in Congress have largely pivoted to denying or dismissing what happened and rallied once again around Donald Trump, arguing he was not culpable. House leaders sent out a notice on Tuesday encouraging their members to fight the contempt charges against Mark Meadows. Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, said the committee's investigation was a political charade focused solely on persecuting Donald Trump and his allies. "Mark Meadows is our former colleague. He's a good man. He's my friend," Jim Jordan said during debate on the contempt referral. "This is as wrong as it gets. You all know it, but your lust for power, your lust to get your opponents, is so intense you don't care." The vote would be the second time in recent weeks that the House voted to hold an ally of Donald Trump in contempt of Congress for refusing to sit for deposition. Steve Bannon was indicted by a federal grand jury last month after the House voted to recommend that he be found in contempt for refusing to cooperate with the committee. Unlike Steve Bannon, who was not a member of the government during the run-up to the 6th of January, Mark Meadows, who was one of Donald Trump's closest White House advisors during the attack, may have a stronger case against cooperating with a congressional inquiry that seeks confidential communications with the president that could be protected by executive privilege. But Democrats argued that Mark Meadows' decision to furnish thousands of documents that are not privileged only underscored his obligation to speak to investigators about what he knew. They chalked up his change in stance to pressure from the former president, who objected to portions of Mark Meadows' newly released book. In an investigation like ours, when you produce records, you are expected to come in and answer questions about those records, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the committee. Benny Thompson added, "But that's not what he did. He told us the day before his deposition, the same day his book was published, that he would no longer cooperate with our investigation and that he wasn't coming in to be interviewed." Mark Meadows and his lawyer, George Terwilliger, vigorously protested the charge on Tuesday before the House action. Mr. Terwilliger said Mark Meadows never stopped cooperating with the committee, arguing he has cooperated as much as he could without violating Donald Trump's assertions of executive privilege. Mr. Meadows has filed a lawsuit against the panel to seek a court ruling to determine the validity of Donald Trump's assertions of executive privilege. "He has fully cooperated as to documents in his possession that are not privileged and has sought various means to provide other information while continuing to honor the former president's privilege claims," Mr. Terwilliger said, pointing out that his client had provided the panel with voluminous evidence. On Monday, 13th of December, the committee voted 9-0 to recommend that Mark Meadows be charged with criminal contempt of Congress. Mark Meadows said later in an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity that the vote against him was disappointing but not surprising. He argued that the committee was focusing solely on Donald Trump at the expense of security lapses at the Capitol. "I've tried to share non-privileged information," he said, "but truly the executive privilege that Donald Trump has claimed is his to waive. It's not mine to waive." The documents Mark Meadows has furnished have shown that he played a far more substantial role in plans to try to overturn the 2020 presidential election than was previously known. Among the documents Mark Meadows provided the committee was a message in which he indicated the National Guard would be available to protect pro-Trump people on 6th of January. Mr. Meadows told Sean Hannity the former president wanted thousands of troops ready. But the Guard was not deployed quickly enough on 6th of January as the violence unfolded, with its former commanding officer testifying that he had to wait for more than 3 hours for approval to send in his troops. In an effort to speed up Guard deployment, the House approved a bill to empower the Chief of the U.S. Capitol Police to unilaterally request the assistance of the District of Columbia National Guard or other federal law enforcement agencies in emergencies without prior approval of the Capitol Police Board. The measure had passed the Senate on Monday and now heads for President Biden's desk.